The costumes? The notepads?
Silence.
You are quite the political prisoners. Not giving a thing away. All right. May one ask what it is that you are protesting about?
Both children pointed urgently to their armbands.
Vegetables? You are protesting for the rights of vegetables.
Irie held one hand over her mouth to stop herself screaming the answer, while Majeed set about his writing pad in a flurry.
We are protesting about the harvest festival.
Samad growled. I told you already. I don't want you participating in that nonsense. It has nothing to do with us, Majeed. Why are you always trying to be somebody you are not?
There was a mutual, silent anger as each acknowledged the painful incident that was being referred to. A few months earlier, on Majeed's 9th birthday, a group of very nice-looking white boys with meticulous manners had turned up on the doorstep and asked for Mark Smith.
Mark? No Mark here,
Alsana had said, bending down to their level with a genial smile.
Only the family Iqbal in here. You have the wrong house.
But before she had finished the sentence, Majeed had dashed to the door, ushering his mother out of view.
Hi, guys. Hi, Mark. Off to the chess club, Mum.
Yes, Mark,
said Alsana, close to tears at this final snub. The replacement of Mum for Amma.
Do not be late now.
I give you a glorious name like Majeed Mehfooz Murshid Mubtasim Iqbal,
Samad had yelled after Majeed when he returned home that evening and whipped up the stairs like a bullet to hide in his room.
And you want to be called Mark Smith?
But this was just a symptom of a far deeper malaise. Majeed really wanted to be in some other family. He wanted to own cats and not cockroaches. He wanted his mother to make the music of the cello, not the sound of the sewing machine. He wanted to have a trellis of flowers growing up one side of the house instead of the ever-growing pile of other people's rubbish. He wanted a piano in the hallway in place of the broken door of cousin Khurshed's car. He wanted to go on biking holidays to France, not day trips to Blackpool to visit aunties. He wanted the floor of his room to be shiny wood, not the orange and green swirled carpet left over from the restaurant. He wanted his father to be a doctor, not a one-handed waiter. And this month, Majeed had converted all these desires into a wish to join in with the harvest festival like Mark Smith would, like everybody else would.
But we want to do it, or we'll get a detention. Mrs. Owens said it is tradition.
Samad blew his top.
Whose tradition?
He bellowed, as a tearful Majeed began to scribble frantically once more.
Damn it! You are a Muslim, not a wood sprite. I told you, Majeed, I told you the condition upon which you would be allowed. You come with me on Hajj. If I am to touch that black stone before I die, I will do it with my eldest son by my side.
Majeed broke the pencil halfway through his reply, scrawling the second half with blunt lead.
It's not fair. I can't go on Hajj. I've got to go to school. I don't have time to go to Mecca. It's not fair. Welcome to the 20th century. It's not fair. It's never fair.
Majid ripped the next piece of paper from the pad and held it up in front of his father's face.
You told her dad not to let her go.
Samad couldn't deny it. Last Tuesday, he had asked Archie to show solidarity by keeping Irie at home the week of the festival. Archie had hedged and haggled, fearing Clara's wrath. But Samad had reassured him.
Take a leaf from my book, Archibald. Who wears the trousers in my house?
Archie had thought about Alsana, so often found in those lovely silken trousers with the tapered ankle, and of Samad, who regularly wore a long piece of embroidered grey cotton, a lungi wrapped around his waist, to all intents and purposes, a skirt. But he kept the thought to himself.
We won't speak if you don't let us go. We won't speak ever, 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 ever again. When we die, everyone will say it was you. You, you, you.
Great, thought Samad.
More blood and sticky guilt on my one good hand.
Samad didn't know anything about conducting, but he knew what he liked. True, it probably wasn't very complex, the way she did it. Just a simple 3-4, just a one-dimensional metronome drawn in the air with her index finger, but, ah, what a joy it was to watch her do it. Her back to him, her bare feet lifting on every third beat, out of her slip-on shoes, her backside protruding ever so slightly, pressing up against the jeans each time she lunged forward for one of the orchestra's ham-fisted crescendos. What a joy it was.
What a vision!
It was all he could do to stop himself rushing at her and carrying her off. It frightened him, the extent to which he could not take his eyes off her. But he had to rationalize.
The orchestra needed her. God knows they were never going to get through this adaptation of Swan Lake, more reminiscent of ducks waddling through an oil slick, without her.
Yet, what a terrific waste, it seemed. Akin to watching a toddler on a bus mindlessly grabbing the breast of the stranger sitting next to him. What a waste that something of such beauty should be at the disposal of those too young to know what to do with it. The second he tasted this thought, he brought it back up.
Samad Mia, surely a man has reached his lowest when he is jealous of the child at a woman's breast, when he is jealous of the young, of the future.
And then, not for the first time that afternoon, as Poppy Burt Jones lifted out of her shoes once more and the ducks finally succumbed to the environmental disaster, he asked himself,
why, in the name of Allah, am I here?
And the answer returned once more with the persistence of vomit.
Because I simply cannot be anywhere else.
Tick, tick, tick. Samad was thankful for the sound of baton hitting on music stand, which interrupted him from these thoughts. These thoughts that was something close to delirium.
Now, kids, kids, stop. Shh, quieten down. Mouths away from instruments. Bows down. Down, Anita. That's it. Yes, on the floor. Thank you. Now, you've probably noticed we have a visitor today.
She turned to him, and he tried hard to find some part of her on which to focus, some inch that did not heat his troubled blood.
This is Mr. Iqbal, Majid's and Milat's father.
Samad stood up, as if he'd been called to attention, draped his wide-lapelled overcoat carefully over his volatile crotch, waved rather lamely, sat back down,
Say, "Hello, Mr. Iqbal." "Hello, Mr. Iqbal,"
came the resounding chorus from all but two of the musicians.
"Now, don't we want to play thrice as well, because we have an audience?" "Yes, Miss Bird Jones." "And not only is Mr. Iqbal our audience for today, but he's a very special audience. It's because of Mr. Iqbal that next week we won't be playing Swan Lake anymore."
A great roar met this announcement, accompanied by a stray chorus of trumpet hoots, drum rolls, a cymbal. All right, enough. I didn't expect quite so much joyous approval." Samad smiled. She had humor then. There was wit there, a bit of sharpness. But why think, the more reasons there were to sin, the smaller the sin was. He was thinking like a Christian again. He was saying, "Can't say fairer than that to the Creator."
"Instruments down. Yes, you, Marvin. Thank you very much." "What'll we be doing instead then, miss?"
"Well," began Poppy Bird Jones, the same half-coy, half-daring smile he had noticed before.
"Something very exciting. Next week, I want to try to experiment with some Indian music."
The cymbal player, dubious of what place he would occupy in such a radical change of genre, took it upon himself to be the first to ridicule the scheme.
"What? You mean that E-I-E-I-U-I-O music?"
he said, doing a creditable impression of the strains to be found at the beginning of a Hindi musical, or in the back room of an Indian restaurant, along with attendant head movements. The class let out a blast of laughter as loud as the brass section and echoed the gag en masse.
E-I-E-I-O-I-O-I-A.
This, along with screeching parodic violins, penetrated Samad's deep, erotic half-slumber and sent his imagination into a garden. A garden encased in marble, where he found himself dressed in white and hiding behind a large tree, spying on a besarid, bindi-wearing Poppy Bird Jones, as she wound flirtatiously in and out of some fountains, sometimes visible, sometimes not.
"I don't think,"
began Poppy Bird Jones, trying to force her voice above the hoo-ha, then raising it several decibels.
"I don't think it is very nice to..."
And here, her voice slipped back to normal, as the class registered the angry tone and quietened down.
"I don't think it is very nice to make fun of somebody else's culture."
The orchestra, unaware that this is what they had been doing, but aware that this was the most heinous crime in the manor school rulebook, looked to their collective feet.
Do you? How would you like it, Sophie, if someone made fun of Queen?
Sophie, a vaguely retarded 12-year-old covered from head to toe in that particular rock band's paraphernalia, glared over a pair of bottle-top spectacles.
"Wouldn't like it, miss." "No, you wouldn't, would you?"
"No, miss. Because Freddie Mercury is from your culture."
Samad had heard the rumors that ran through the rank and file of the palace waiters to the effect that this Mercury character was in actual fact a very light-skinned Persian called Farooq, whom the head chef remembered from school in Panchkani near Bombay. But who wished to split hairs? Not wanting to stop the lovely Bert Jones while she was in something of a flow, Samad kept the information to himself.
"Sometimes we find other people's music strange because their culture is different from ours," said Miss Bert Jones solemnly. "But that doesn't mean it isn't equally good now, does it?"
"No, miss."
"And we can learn about each other
through each other's culture, can't we? Yes, miss. For example, what music do you like, Millat?
Millat thought for a moment, swung his saxophone to his side, and began fingering it like a guitar.
Born to run, da-da-da-da-da, Bruce Springsteen, miss, da-da-da-da-da, baby, we were born. Nothing else? Something you listen to at home, maybe?
Millat's face fell, troubled that his answer did not seem to be the right one. He looked over at his father, who was gesticulating wildly behind the teacher, trying to convey the jerky head and hand movements of Bharatanatyam, the form of dance Alsana had once enjoyed before sadness weighted her heart, and babies tied down her hands and feet.
Thriller,
sang Millat, full-throated, believing he had caught his father's jest.
Thriller night, Michael Jackson, miss, Michael Jackson.
Samad put his head in his hands. Miss Bert Jones looked queerly at the small child standing on a chair, gyrating and grabbing his crotch before her.
Okay, thank you, Millat. Thank you for sharing that.
Millat grinned.
No problem, miss.
While the children queued up to exchange 20 pence for 2 dry digestives and a cup of tasteless squash, Samad followed the light foot of Poppy Bert Jones like a predator into the music cupboard, a tiny room, windowless, with no means of escape, and full of instruments, filing cabinets overbrimming with sheet music, and a scent Samad had thought hers, but now identified as the maturing leather of violin cases mixed with the mellowing odor of catgut.
This, said Samad,
spotting a desk beneath a mountain of paper.
Is where you work?
Poppy blushed.
Tiny, isn't it? Music budgets get cut every year. Until this year, there was nothing left to cut from. It's got to the point where they're putting desks in cupboards and calling them offices. If it wasn't for the GLC, there wouldn't even be a desk.
It is certainly small, said Samad,
scanning the room desperately for some spot where he might stand that would put her out of arm's reach.
One might almost say claustrophobic.
I know, it's awful, but won't you sit down?
Samad looked for the chair she might be referring to.
Oh God, I'm sorry, it's here.
She swept paper, books and rubbish onto the floor with one hand, revealing a perilous-looking stool.
I made it, but it's pretty safe.
You excel in carpentry?
Inquired Samad, searching once again for more good reasons to commit a bad sin.
An artisan as well as a musician?
No, no, no. I went to a few night classes, nothing special. I made that and a footstool, and the footstool broke. Do you know, I can't think of a single carpenter.
There is always Jesus. But I can't very well say I'm no Jesus. I mean, obviously I'm not,
but for other reasons.
Samad took his wobbly seat as Poppy Bert Jones went to sit behind her desk.
Meaning you are not a good person?
Samad saw that he had flustered her with the accidental solemnity of the question. She drew her fingers through her fringe, fiddled with a small tortoiseshell button on her blouse, laughed shakily.
I like to think I'm not all bad.
And that is enough?
Well, I...
Oh, my dear, I apologize, began Samad. I was not being serious, Miss Bert Jones.
Well, let's say I'm no Mr. Chippendale. That'll do.
Yes,
said Samad kindly, thinking to himself that she had far better legs than a Queen Anne chair.
That will do.
Now, where were we?
Summerd leant a little over the desk to face her.
Were we somewhere, Miss Bert Jones?
He used his eyes. He remembered people used to say that it was his eyes. That new boy in Delhi, Samad Mia, they said. He has eyes to die for.
I was looking, I was looking for my notes. Where are my notes?
She began rifling through the catastrophe of her desk, and Samad leant back once more on his stool, taking what little satisfaction he could from the fact that her fingers, if he was not mistaken, appeared to be trembling. Had there been a moment just then? He was 57. It was a good 10 years since he'd had a moment. He was not all sure he would recognize a moment if one came along. You old man, he told himself as he dabbed at his face with a handkerchief. You old fool. Leave now. Leave before you drown in your own guilty excretions, for he was sweating like a pig. Leave before you make it worse. But was it possible? Was it possible that this past month, the month that he had been squeezing and spilling, praying and begging, making deals and thinking always about her, that she had been thinking of him?
Oh, while I'm looking, I remember there was something I wanted to ask you.
Yes,
said the anthropomorphized voice that had taken up residence in Samad's right testicle. Whatever the question, the answer is yes, yes, yes. Yes, we will make love upon this very table. Yes, we will burn for it, and yes, Miss Bert Jones, yes. The answer is inevitably, inescapably, yes. Yet somehow, out there where conversation continued, in the rational world, 4 feet above his ball bag, the answer turned out to be Wednesday.
Bobby laughed. No, I don't mean what day it is. I don't look that ditzy, do I? No, I meant, what day is it? I mean, for Muslims. Only I saw Majid was in some kind of costume, and when I asked him what it was for, he wouldn't speak. I was terribly worried that I'd offended him somehow.
Samad frowned. It is odious to be reminded of one's children when one is calculating the exact shade and rigidity of a nipple that could so assert itself through bra and shirt.
Majid? Please do not worry yourself about Majid. I am sure he was not offended.
So I was right, said Poppy gleefully. It is like a type of, I don't know, vocal fasting?
Yes,
stumbled Samad, not wishing to divulge his family dilemma.
It is a symbol of the Quran's assertion that the day of reckoning would first strike us all unconscious. Silent, you see. So the eldest son of the family dresses in black and disdains speech for a period of time as a process of purification.
Dear God.
I see. That's just fascinating. And Majid is the elder?
By 2 minutes.
Poppy smiled.
Only just then?
2 minutes, said Samad patiently, because he was speaking to one with no knowledge of the impact such small periods of time had amounted to throughout the history of the Iqbal family.
Made all the difference.
And does the process have a name?
Amar turbo lagche.
What does it mean?
Literal translation, I feel weak. It means, Miss Bert Jones, that every strand of me feels weakened by the desire to kiss you.
It means, said Samad aloud, without missing a beat, closed mouth worship of the Creator.
Amar durbol lakche. Wow, said Poppy Bert Jones.
Indeed,
said Samad Mia. Poppy Bert Jones leant forward in her chair.
I don't know. To me, it's just like this incredible act of self-control. We just don't have that in the West, that sense of sacrifice. I just have so much admiration for the sense your people have of abstinence, of self-restraint.
At which point, Samad kicked the stool from under him like a man hanging himself, and met the loquacious lips of Poppy Bert Jones with his own feverish bear.
7. Molars. And the sins of the Eastern Father shall be visited upon the Western sons. Often taking their time, stored up in the genes like baldness or testicular carcinoma, but sometimes on the very same day. Sometimes at the very same moment. At least, that would explain how 2 weeks later, during the old Druid festival of harvest, Samad can be found quietly packing the one shirt he's never worn to mosque, to the pure, all things are pure, into a plastic bag, so that he might change later and meet Miss Bert Jones, 4:30, Harlesden clock, without arousing suspicion. While Majid and a change of heart Millat slip only 4 cans of past their sell-by date chickpeas, a bag of variety crisps, and some apples into 2 rucksacks. Can't say fairer than that. In preparation for a meeting with Irie, 4:30, ice cream van, and a visit to their assigned old man, the one to whom they will offer pagan charity, one Mr. J.P. Hamilton of Kensal Rise. Unbeknownst to all involved, ancient ley lines run underneath these 2 journeys, or, to put it in the modern parlance, this is a rerun. We have been here before. This is like watching TV in Bombay or Kingston or Dhaka, watching the same old British sitcoms spewed out to the old colonies in one tedious, eternal loop. Because immigrants have always been particularly prone to repetition. It's something to do with that experience of moving from west to east, or east to west, or from island to island. Even when you arrive, you're still going back and forth. Your children are going round and round. There's no proper term for it. Original sin seems too harsh. Maybe original trauma would be better. A trauma is something one repeats and repeats, after all, and this is the tragedy of the Iqbals, that they can't help but reenact the dash they once made from one land to another, from one faith to another, from one brown mother country into the pale, freckled arms of an imperial sovereign. It will take a few replays before they move on to the next tune. And this is what is happening as Alsana soars loudly on her monstrous singer machine, double-stitching around the vacancy of a crotchless knicker, oblivious to the father and the sons who are creeping around the house, packing clothes, packing provisions. It is a visitation of repetition. It is a dash across continents. It is a rerun. But one at a time now, one at a time. Now, how do the young prepare to meet the old? The same way the old prepare to meet the young. With a little condescension. With low expectation of the other's rationality. With the knowledge that the other will find what they say hard to understand. That it will go beyond them, not so much over the head as between the legs. and with the feeling that they must arrive with something the other will like, something suitable, like Garibaldi biscuits.
They like them,
explained Irie, when the twins queried her choice, as the three of them rumbled to their destination on the top of the 52 bus.
They like the raisins in them. Old people like raisins.
Millat, from under the cocoon of his Tommytronic, sniffed.
Nobody likes raisins. Dead grapes, bleh. Who wants to eat them?
Old people do,
Irie insisted, stuffing the biscuits back into her bag.
And they're not dead, actually. They're dried.
Yeah, after they've died.
Shut up, Millat. Majid, tell him to shut up.
Majid pushed his glasses up to the bridge of his nose and diplomatically changed the subject.
What else have you got?
Irie reached into her bag.
A coconut.
A coconut?
For your information,
snapped Irie, moving the nut out of Millat's reach.
Old people like coconuts. They can use the milk for their tea.
Irie pressed on in the face of Millat retching.
And I got some crusty French bread and some cheese singlets and some apples.
We got apples, you chief, cut in Millat.
Chief, for some inexplicable reason hidden in the etymology of North London slang, meaning fool, ass, wanker, a loser of the most colossal proportions.
Well, I got some more and better apples, actually, and some Kendall mint cake, and some ackee and salt fish.
I hate ackee and salt fish.
Who said you were eating it?
I don't want to.
Well, you're not going to.
Well, good, 'cause I don't want to.
Well, good, 'cause I wouldn't let you even if you wanted to.
Well, that's lucky, 'cause I don't, so shame, said Millat.
And without removing his Tommytronic, he delivered shame, as was traditionally the way, by dragging his palm along Irie's forehead.
Shame in the brain.
Well, actually, don't worry, 'cause you're not going to get it.
Ooh, feel the heat, feel the heat,
squealed Majid, rubbing his little palm in.
You've been shamed, man. Actually, I'm not shamed. You're shamed, 'cause it's for Mr. J.P. Hamilton.
Our stop,
cried Majid, shooting to his feet and pulling the bell cord too many times.
If you ask me,
said one disgruntled OAP to another,
they should all go back to their own.
But this, the oldest sentence in the world, found itself stifled by the ringing of bells and the stamping of feet, until it retreated under the seats with the chewing gum.
Shame, shame, know your name,
trilled Majid. The three of them hurtled down the stairs and off the bus. And the 52 bus goes two ways. From the Willesden kaleidoscope, one can catch it west like the children, through Kensal Rise to Portobello to Knightsbridge, and watch the many colours shade off into the bright white lights of town. Or you can get it east, as some other did, Willesden, Dollis Hill, Harlesden, and watch with dread if you are fearful like some other. If all you have learned from the city is to cross the road at the sight of dark-skinned men, as white fades to yellow fades to brown, and then Harlesden clock comes into view, standing like Queen Victoria's statue in Kingston, a tall stone surrounded by black. Samad had been surprised, yes, surprised, that it was Harlesden, she had whispered to him when he pressed her hand after the kiss. That kiss he could still taste, and demanded where it was he might find her. Away from here, far from here.
My children, my wife, he had mumbled, incoherent,
expecting Islington, or maybe West Hampstead, or at least Swiss Cottage, and getting instead,
Harlesden. I live in Harlesden.
Stonebridge Estate?
Samad had asked, alarmed, wide-eyed at the creative ways Allah found to punish him, envisioning himself atop his new lover with a gangster's 4-inch knife in his back.
No, but not far from there. Do you want to meet up?
Samad's mouth had been the lone gunman on the grassy knoll that day, killing off his brain and swearing itself into power all at the same time.
Yes, oh damn it, yes.
And then he had kissed her again, turning something relatively chaste into something else, cupping her breast in his left hand and enjoying her sharp intake of breath as he did so. Then they had the short, obligatory exchange that those who cheat have to make them feel less like those who cheat.
I really shouldn't.
I'm not sure at all how this...
Well, we need to meet at least to discuss what has...
Indeed, what has happened. It must be discussed...
Because something has happened here. But...
My wife. My children.
Let's give it some time. 2 weeks Wednesday. 4:30. Halsden clock.
He could at least, in this sordid mess, congratulate himself on his timing. 4:15 by the time he got off the bus, which left 5 minutes to nip into the McDonald's toilets that had black guards on the door, black guards to keep out the blacks, and squeeze out of the restaurant flares into a dark blue suit with a wool V-neck and a grey shirt, the pocket of which contained a comb to work his thick hair into some obedient form, by which time it was 4:20. 5 minutes in which to visit cousin Hakim and his wife Zinat, who ran the local pound plus 50p shop, a type of shop that trades under the false premise that it sells no items above this price, but on closer inspection proves to be the minimum price of the stock, and whom he meant inadvertently to provide him with an alibi.
Samad Mia, oh, so smart looking today. It cannot be without a reason.
Zinat Mahal, a mouth as large as the Black Wall Tunnel, and Samad was relying upon it.
Thank you, Zinat,
said Samad, looking deliberately disingenuous.
As for a reason, I am not sure that I should say.
Samad, my mouth is like the grave. Whatever is told to me dies with me.
Whatever was told to Zinat invariably lit up the telephone network, rebounded off aerials, radio waves and satellites along the way, picked up finally by advanced alien civilizations as it bounced through the atmosphere of planets far removed from this one.
Well, the truth is...
By Allah, get on with it!
Cried Zinat, who was now almost on the other side of the counter. Such was her delight in gossip.
Where are you off to?
Well, I am off to see a man in Park Royal about life insurance. I want my Alsana well provided for after my death. But, he said, waggling a finger at his sparkling jewel-covered interrogator who wore too much eyeshadow, I don't want her to know. Thoughts of death are abhorrent to her, Zinat.
Do you hear that, Hakim? Some men worry about the future of their wives. Go on, get out of here. Don't let me keep you, cousin. And don't worry.
She called after him, simultaneously reaching for the phone with her long, curling fingernails.
I won't say one word to Alsi.
Alibi done. 3 minutes were left for Samad to consider what an old man brings a young girl. Something an old brown man brings a young white girl at the crossroads of 4 black streets. Something suitable.
A coconut?
Poppy Burt Jones took the hairy object into her hands and looked up at Samad with a perplexed smile.
It is a mixed-up thing, began Samad nervously. With juice like a fruit, but hard like a nut. Brown and old on the outside, white and fresh on the inside. But the mix is not, I think, bad. We use it sometimes, he added, not knowing what else to say. In curry.
Poppy smiled, a terrific smile which accentuated every natural beauty of that face and had in it, Samad thought, something better than this, something with no shame in it, something better and purer than what they were doing.
It's lovely, she said.
Out in the street and 5 minutes from the address on their school sheets, Irie still felt the irritable hot sting of shame and wanted a rematch.
Tax that, she said,
pointing to a rather beat-up motorbike leaning by Kensal Rise Tube.
Tax that and that,
indicating two BMXs beside it. Millat and Majid jumped into action. The practice of taxing something, whereby one lays claim, like a newly arrived colonizer, to items in the street that do not belong to you, was well known and beloved to both of them.
Cha, man, believe, I don't want to tax that crap, said Millat with the Jamaican accent that all kids, whatever their nationality, used to express scorn. I tax dat, he said, pointing out an admittedly impressive, small, shiny, red MG about to turn the corner.
And dat, he cried, getting there just before Majid as a BMW whizzed past.
Man, you know I tax that, he said to Majid,
who offered no dispute.
Blatantly.
Irie, a little dejected by this turn of events, turned her eyes from the road to the floor, where she was suddenly struck by a flash of inspiration.
I tax those!
Majid and Millat stopped and looked in awe at the perfectly white Nikes that were now in Irie's possession, with one red tick, one blue, so beautiful, as Millat later remarked, it made you want to kill yourself. Though to the naked eye, they appeared to be walking towards Queen's Park, attached to a tall, natty dread black kid. Millat nodded grudgingly.
Respect to that. I wish I'd see them.
Dax,
said Majid suddenly, pushing his grubby finger up against some shop glass in the direction of a 4-foot-long chemistry set with an aging TV personality's face on the front. He thumped the window.
Wow, I tax that.
A brief silence ensued.
You tax that? Asked Millat, incredulous. That? You tax a chemistry set?
Before poor Majid knew where he was, two palms had made a ferocious slap on his forehead and were doing much rubbing for good measure. Majid gave Irie an et tu brute type of pleading look in the full knowledge that it was useless. There is no honesty amongst almost 10-year-olds.
Shame, shame, know your name.
But Mr. J.P. Hamilton, moaned Majid from under the heat of shame. We're here now. His house is just there. It's a quiet street. You can't make all this noise. He's old.
But if he's old, he'll be deaf, reasoned Millat. And if you're deaf, you can't hear.
It doesn't work like that. It's hard for old people. You don't understand.
He's probably too old to take the stuff out of the bags, said Irie. We should take them out and carry them in our hands.
This was agreed upon, and some time was taken arranging all the foodstuffs in their hands and crevices of the body so that they might surprise Mr. J.P. Hamilton with the extent of their charity when he answered the door. Mr. J.P. Hamilton, confronted on his doorstep by three dark-skinned children clutching a myriad of projectiles, was duly surprised. As old as they had imagined, but far taller and cleaner, he opened the door only slightly, keeping his hand, with its mountain range of blue veins, upon the knob, while his head curled around the frame. To Irie, he was reminiscent of some genteel elderly eagle. Tufts of feather-like hair protruded from eardrums, shirt cuffs, and the neck, with one white spray
falling over his forehead. His fingers lay in a permanent tight spasm, like talons, and he was well-dressed, as one might expect of an elderly English bird in Wonderland. A suede waistcoat and a tweed jacket, and a watch on a gold chain. And twinkling like a magpie, from the blue scattering in his eyes undimmed by the white and red surround, to the gleam of a signet ring, 4 argent medals perched just above his heart, and the silver rim of a senior service packet peeping over the breast pocket.
"Please," came the voice from the birdman,
a voice that even the children sensed was from a different class, a different era.
"I must ask that you remove yourselves from my doorstep. I have no money whatsoever. So be your intention robbing or selling, I'm afraid you will be disappointed."
Majid stepped forward, trying to place himself in the old man's eyeline, for the left eye, blue as Rayleigh scattering, had looked beyond them, while the right was so compacted beneath wrinkles it hardly opened.
"Mr. Hamilton, don't you remember? The school sent us. These are..."
He said,
"Goodbye now,"
as if he were bidding farewell to an elderly aunt embarking on a train journey. Then once more,
"Goodbye."
And through 2 panels of cheap stained glass on the closed door, the children watched the lengthy figure of Mr. Hamilton, blurred as if by heat, walking slowly away from them down a corridor, until the brown flecks of him merged with the brown flecks of the household furnishings, and the former all but disappeared. Millet pulled his Tommytronic down around his neck, frowned, and purposefully slammed his little fist into the doorbell, holding it down.
"Maybe," suggested Irie, "he doesn't want the stuff."
Millet released the doorbell briefly.
"He's got to want it. He asked for it," he growled,
pushing the bell back down with his full force.
"It's God's harvest, isn't it? Mr. Hamilton? Mr. J.P. Hamilton?"
And then that slow process of disappearance began to rewind as he reconstituted himself via the atoms of a staircase and a dresser until he was large as life once more, curled around the door. Millet, lacking patience, thrust his school information sheet into his hand.
"It's God's harvest!"
But the old man shook his head like a bird in a birdbath.
"No, no, I really won't be intimidated into purchases on my own doorstep. I don't know what you are selling. Please, God, let it not be encyclopedias. At my age, it is not more information one requires, but less."
"But it's free."
"Oh, yes, I see. Why?"
"It's God's harvest," repeated Majid. "Helping the local community. Mr. Hamilton, you must have spoken to our teacher because she sent us here. Maybe it slipped your mind?"
added Irie in her grown-up voice. Mr. Hamilton touched his temple sadly, as if to retrieve the memory, and then ever so slowly opened his front door to full tilt and made a pigeon step forward into the autumn sunlight.
"Well, you'd better come in."
They followed Mr. Hamilton into the townhouse gloom of his hall, filled to the brim with battered and chipped Victoriana, punctuated by signs of more recent life, children's broken bikes, a discarded speak and spell, 4 pairs of muddy wellies in a family's variant sizes.
"Now,"
he said cheerily, as they reached the living room with its beautiful bay windows, through which a sweeping garden could be seen.
"What have we got here?"
The children released their load onto a moth-eaten chaise longue, Majid reeling off the contents like items from a shopping list, while Mr. Hamilton lit a cigarette and inspected the urban picnic with doddering fingers.
"Apples? Oh, dear me. No chickpeas? No, no, no.
potato chips. It went on like this, each article being picked up in its turn and chastised, until the old man looked up at them with faint tears in his eyes.
I can't eat any of this, you see. Too hard. Too bloody hard. The most I could manage is probably the milk in that coconut. Still, we will have tea, won't we? You'll stay for tea.
The children looked at him blankly.
Go on, my dears. Do sit down.
Irie, Majid and Millat shuffled up nervously on the chaise longue. Then there was a click-clack sound, and when they looked up, Mr. Hamilton's teeth were on his tongue, as if a second mouth had come out of the first. And then in a flash, they were back in.
I simply cannot eat anything unless it has been pulverized beforehand, you see. My own fault. Years and years of neglect. Clean teeth? Never a priority in the army.
He signaled himself clumsily, an awkward jab at his own chest with a shaking hand.
I was an army man, you see. Now, how many times do you young people brush your teeth?
3 times a day,
said Irie, lying.
Liar,
chorused Millat and Majid.
Pants on fire.
2.5 times.
Well, dear me, which is it?
Said Mr. Hamilton, smoothing down his trousers with one hand and lifting his tea with the other.
1 a day,
said Irie sheepishly, the concern in his voice compelling her to tell the truth.
Most days.
I fear you will come to regret that. And you too?
Majid was midway through formulating some elaborate fantasy of a toothbrush machine that did it while you slept. But Millat came clean.
Same. 1 a day. More or less.
Mr. Hamilton leant back contemplatively in his chair.
One sometimes forgets the significance of one's teeth. We're not like the lower animals, teeth replaced regularly and all that. We're of the mammals, you see. And mammals only get 2 chances with teeth. More sugar?
The children, mindful of their 2 chances, declined.
But like all things, the business has 2 sides. Clean white teeth are not always wise, now are they? Par exemplum, when I was in the Congo, the only way I could identify the nigger was by the whiteness of his teeth, if you see what I mean. Horrid business. Dark as buggery it was. And they died because of it, you see? Poor bastards. Or rather, I survived, to look at it in another way. Do you see?
The children sat silently, and then Irie began to cry, ever so quietly. Mr. Hamilton continued,
Those are the split decisions you make in war. See a flash of white and bang, as it were. Dark as buggery, oh, terrible times. All these beautiful boys lying dead there, right in front of me, right at my feet. Stomachs open, you know, with their guts on my shoes. Like the end of the bloody world. Beautiful men, enlisted by the Krauts, black as the ace of spades.
Poor fools. Didn't even know why they were there. What people they were fighting for. Who they were shooting at. The decision of the gun. So quick, children. So brutal.
Biscuit? I want to go home,
whispered Irie.
My dad was in the war. He played for England,
piped up Millat, red-faced and furious.
Well, boy, do you mean the football team or the army?
The British Army. He drove a tank, Mr. Churchill, with her dad,
explained Majid.
I'm afraid you must be mistaken, said Mr. Hamilton,
genteel as ever.
There were certainly no wogs, as I remember, though you're probably not allowed to say that these days, are you? But no, no Pakistanis. What would we have fed them? No, no, he grumbled,
assessing the question as if he were being given the opportunity to rewrite history here and now.
Quite out of the question. I could not possibly have stomached that rich food. No Pakistanis. The Pakistanis would have been in the Pakistani army, you see, whatever that was. As for the poor Brits, they had enough on their hands. With us old queens.
Mr. Hamilton laughed softly to himself, turned his head, and silently admired the roaming branches of a cherry tree that dominated one whole corner of his garden. After a long pause, he turned back, and tears were visible in his eyes again. Fast, sharp tears, as if he had been slapped in the face.
Now, you young men shouldn't tell fibs, should you? Fibs will rot your teeth.
It's not a lie, Mr. J.P. Hamilton. He really was, said Majid,
always the peacemaker, always the negotiator.
He was shot in the hand. He has medals. He was a hero.
And when your teeth rot?
It's the truth,
shouted Millat, kicking over the tea tray that sat on the floor between them.
You stupid fucking old man!
And when your teeth rot, continued Mr. Hamilton, smiling at the ceiling, there's no return. They won't look at you like they used to. The pretty ones won't give you a second glance, not for love or money, but while you're still young. The important matter is the third molars. They are more commonly referred to as the wisdom teeth, I believe. You simply must deal with the third molars before anything else. That was my downfall. You won't have them yet, but my great-grandchildren are just feeling them now. The problem with third molars is one is never sure whether one's mouth will be quite large enough to accommodate them. They are the only part of the body that a man must grow into. He must be a big enough man for these teeth, do you see? Because if not, oh dear me, they grow crooked, or any which way. Or refuse to grow at all. They stay locked up there with the bone. An impaction, I believe, is the term, and terrible terrible infection ensues.
Have them out early.
That's what I tell my granddaughter.